And 977-1070 is the phone number, or if you're listening from out of the area, 434-977-1070. Thanks for joining us here on The Shilling Show. It's our pleasure each month to welcome David Murata to the program, president of Murata Wealth Management, online at emurata.com. And today, it's the costs of low economic freedom and high debt. These are things to consider, not only politically, but also investment-wise. David Murata, welcome to The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
I want to start off and kind of set the plate by talking about these Ring of Fire countries, because you have advised, and in fact, I think we talked about it a year ago when you first wrote the column, that people ought to avoid investing in Ring of Fire countries. What does that mean?
The Ring of Fire was a term coined by Bill Gross in March of 2010. And what he did is he looked at how much deficit countries were running every single year and how much debt they had accumulated. And in the lower right quadrant was the high debt and deficit countries. And he drew a big circle around them. And in his graphic, he actually made the circle on fire. And he called it the Ring of Fire. Mm-hmm. And he said, avoid these countries because sovereign debt is the most important domino to fall in terms of investing. They'll default on their bonds. He's a bond trader, and they'll have lower economic growth. And it turns out that we wrote that column a year ago, and we just finished writing the column, continue to avoid the Ring of Fire countries, because in investing, it's good to make a move, and then a year later, you see whether or not the move paid out. And that's part of the discipline of investing. So we tried to review that a year later, and found out that if you compare the Ring of Fire countries to those with low debt and deficit, the low debt and deficit performed twice what the Ring of Fire countries had performed in a year that should have been an incredible up year.
Now, it was an incredible up year in a way anyway. Even let's just say the United States was just one of the Ring of Fire countries. I mean, it didn't do too badly in the past 12 months. It was what, I recall your chart, about 24, 25%?
Yeah, it was 24%, an incredible year, a great year. But the differences in terms of investing are made of riding the higher waves rather than the lower waves. Mm-hmm. And so if one outperforms the other by 10%, that's 10% that you've lost. And while the United States returned 24%, countries with low debt and deficit returned 36%. That's a huge difference in terms of investing. And that means that those countries could now have a correction and you're still well above the United States, whereas the United States is having its correction and it's underperforming them again on the downside. So if it underperforms them on the downside and it underperforms them on the upside, it just plain old underperforms them. And that's the problem with high debt and deficit countries.
You know, as we look at the United States over the past 12 months, and most recently there has been a pretty serious correction, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, David, but I think I heard that the gains for the year were pretty much gone at this point, at least the calendar year. So as we look at the United States and we say, well, they had, you know, pretty much a bang-up time, at least up until fairly recently. Was that based on anything but speculation? Because we're still in a malaise. I don't think we ever got out of the malaise. Did people just kind of pretend that it wasn't there anymore? Or was there some substantive reason that the United States was even able to do 24%?
Yeah, no, I think it had been beaten down so much that it was recovering on the expectation that our economy would recover. And just sort of anecdotally, we work with a lot of small business owners. And small business owners, at the beginning of the year, actually thought they were doing okay, and a number of them have said what we thought was recovering has kind of fallen off the cliff again, and we're back to not very good economic cash flow for our businesses. And I think a lot of that is the expectations looking forward. Now that the debt and deficit is rising its head and the unemployment is still high, those two together mean we're going to face our own austerity measures, and we may not riot in the streets, but it's certain that the stock market looking forward says this is not a great time. It's an okay time, but it's not a great time.
You know, you say that we may not riot in the streets, and I've heard lots of concern that actually people may start doing that if things get into the position that they are, say, in Greece. What's the latest in Greece, which is one of the Ring of Fire countries, and is that the one in the worst shape?
Greece is clearly in the worst shape. It over the year in which the United States did 24%, Greece was down 9.5%, which is incredible in a year of recovery. The The Ring of Fire countries are Japan, United Kingdom, and then what we call the PIGS, which is Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And, you know, Ireland had a 5.4%, you know, when the United States is having a 24%. Japan was about 7%. And again, this is the Ring of Fire countries struggling with their debt and deficit and their low economic freedom. It's investing in these countries is sort of like planting your seed corn on the sidewalk. You know, it can't take root, and it just gets stepped on by all of the government intervention. You know, you have to put your investments in some kind of fertile soil in order for them to do well. And the fertile soil of high economic freedom and low debt and deficit is one corn returns multifold, whereas in the other ones, you know, one corn, you're lucky if you get your seed corn back for the next year. And that's the difference between between having high debt deficit and not having it. People seem to think that the debt and deficit is not that great a problem, but it is a huge problem that probably loses on average at least 3 or 4%, as opposed to the American growth of 6.5% growth, you know, the European malaise of 3 or 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this past year, our growth was incredibly sluggish. It's growing at about 1.8% right now. And we still have unemployment at 8.7. And these are the direct results of the high government intervention and the high government spending over the last 2 years.
And let's talk about Ireland for just a second, because I was surprised to hear that they were in the Ring of Fire countries, particularly because it was not long ago, and maybe even within the past decade or so, that Ireland was a shining star. They were having this resurgence in the country, and people were moving manufacturing plants there. They were considered to have a very well-trained workforce. What happened to Ireland in such a short time, or was that all just window dressing?
No, I need to do an article on Ireland, and I've been doing some of the research. Ireland was forced to take on certain measures as part of trying to join the European Union. Why they wanted to join the European Union, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But they were largely to take on things to make it fairer, so all the businesses wouldn't flee to Ireland, so they had to start taxing businesses at higher rate. And they were counting on the revenue coming in the way it had come in, so they increased their government spending. So Ireland shot themselves in the foot by trying to adopt things more in line with the European Union and spending at a rate that was not sustainable. So while they might have had great surpluses during the boom years, they just ended up increasing government spending. And government spending is never counted as part of your gross domestic product growth. It never increases your growth. There's a certain amount of government which is necessary in order to have free markets. And it's about 17% of gross domestic product. So countries who have less than 17% of gross domestic product don't have enough government. Countries that have more than 17 or 19% of gross domestic product have too much government. And it's easy to flip from one side to the other. All you have to do is to vote for more spending.
Well, we hope that no one wants to do that, but we know there are plenty of people who are certainly in favor of that. Let's talk about the United States and that number, because you mentioned the 17%. Where do we fit on that scale?
We're much higher than that. And I read a very interesting, Thomas Sowell has a very interesting editorial today in which he says, he talks about one of his earliest memories of war, in which a uniformed officer is talking to a peasant woman, and he says simply, "Don't you understand, ma'am? The village isn't there anymore." And he goes on to talk about Social Security, and he says, "Someone needs to say to those who want Social Security and Medicare to continue on unchanged, don't you understand the money isn't there anymore?" We spent that, we made promises, we collected the money, and then we spent that on other things. And so that money isn't there. So to act as though, well, I paid into the system and so I deserve to get out of it. Every single person who paid into the system supported their parents and grandparents. And that money was spent by your parents and grandparents. And now that you're there and you're a huge amount, you can do one of two things. You can burden future generations of trying to go further into debt, or you can acknowledge the fact that you supported your parents and grandparents, and it's not going to be there for you. It's just not going to be there. The money isn't there anymore. And so that's the problem with high debt and deficit, is you don't get as much benefit because the benefit is spent willy-nilly on things that you just kind of think are good ideas, and you then don't have the money when you need it later on. And so now we've got this problem of high debt and deficit.
I'm hoping that people are listening very carefully to David Morata. We're talking today about the costs of low economic freedom and high debt, And I've seen plenty of people in the local newspaper and in this community basically saying, I want mine, I paid into it, I deserve it. And we understand that. But if the money's not there, it's not there. And nothing that you say is going to change that. 977-1070 is the phone number here on The Shilling Show. We welcome your calls, your challenges, your questions for David Murata. And we have lines open at 977-1070. Tommy is standing by. The Shilling Show will continue right after the news. Stay with us. You see, it's in the
blood. So engaging, you can't stop listening. The Shilling Show on News Radio 1070 WINA.
And thank you so much for joining us weekdays from noon to 2. It is The Shilling Show. David Murata is our guest. He's the president of Murata Wealth Management. Online at emurata.com, and we have open phones. Actually, the lines are ringing, so we'll let Tommy grab those calls. We have one open line for you right now at 977-1070. We're talking with David about the costs of low economic freedom and high debt. And it was an interesting point that he brought up about how people just don't want to admit that the money's not there. As we were talking in the last segment, there are people I've seen writing letters to the daily newspaper regarding Social Security and just thinking that we could go on. Heck, we had a congressman here, the boy congressman, Tom Perriello, who very recently, when he was still in office, basically was going along the same path. Hey, it's all there. Don't worry about it. Not a problem. Let's go to the phones, and the lines are full right now, but there will be a line open in just a moment, 977-1070. Greg is calling us from high atop Afton Mountain. Greg, welcome to The Shilling Show. You're on with David Murata.
David, how are you? Hey, Rob, and I understand your argument. I'll be honest with you. I think they should cut Department of Ed, Health, Human Services, everything but military. You there?
Yeah, we're here. We're listening to you.
But I was forced by the point of a gun to pay into Social Security, and I want at least what I paid in it back plus a couple little bit of interest. And the bottom line is, that sounds selfish, but if I had to pay it, I want it back, and they can cut all the others. Mess and food stamps and everything else, but I want my Social Security because I had to pay it by the law. Now, if they give me a tax credit for the rest of my life starting right now for the amount I paid in, I'll go with that. Or a means test where, you know, in other words, you make a whole lot of money, you don't get it. But I hate to say, if I'm forced to pay something, I want my money back. I'm going to sign off and listen.
Okay, you make a great point, and I understand what you're saying, and I think it's a very valid point. I'd like David to respond to that.
Yeah, I completely understand Greg's feelings. Every now and then, those same feelings well up inside of me. My real question is, I'm sure Greg, like every other American, has two parents and four grandparents. And there's the six people who have gotten what Greg's paid in. So Greg, at least it's gone to your family members. The real question is for all of us is, do we want to hold a gun to our children and grandchildren's heads, just like the gun was held to our heads, and make them pay into our system? Because the money just isn't there. That's the problem. And if anyone says, I mean, Rob is right. Some people are trying to say the money is there. If anyone says the money is there, why do we need to raise the debt ceiling if the money is there? If the money is there, you ought to be able to, with current revenue, pay everything that you've got, and you shouldn't need to raise the debt ceiling. So you can't both argue to raise the debt ceiling and say the money is there. It's just not there. So Greg, if it's any consolation, just say, well, we're not going to hold a gun to our children and grandchildren's head and force them to endure what we've endured. Two wrongs don't make a right. And that's probably the best way to say for it. I mentioned Thomas Sowell's article. He ends his article with, since the law does not allow private pension plans to be set up in the financially irresponsible way Social Security is, that is where young people's money should be put if they ever want to see that money again when they reach retirement age. So we need to have a private system where when you put your money in, it's your money and it didn't get spent on someone else. And we need to have a system where no one's holding a gun to someone else's head, forcing them to pay for someone else's retirement. It's a hard pill to swallow, but some generation has to be heroic. My parents' generation and grandparents' generation had to fight World War II. We're going to have to fight the Leviathan of Social Security and Medicaid, and we're going to have to sacrifice for that by not taking it ourselves in order to privatize it for future generations.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it, because I really share Greg's frustration, and I think Greg is maybe just a couple years older than I am, but not much. And I've often thought, you know, if they gave me the opportunity right now to just get out and stop paying, I would just walk away. I'd walk away from what I've paid up to my, you know, to my age through all the years that I've worked, and I'm closer to retirement than I am to having begun work. But I'd be willing to just let it all go in order to get out and to get my own economic freedom back. So it's a hard choice, and I understand people saying, hey, the money should come to me because I paid it in. It was basically taken from me under duress, as Greg said. But there does come a point where someone's got to say, it's time to stop, and I'll be the one who steps aside. Greg, very good call. There's a line open for you right now at 977-1070. Questions, comments, and challenges for David Morata. Let's go to Gary, who's on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the Shilling Show, and you're on with David Morata.
Thank you, Rob, for taking my call. David, can we talk a little bit more about Greece in this sense? Who should bear the responsibility? I was listening to the BBC World Service, and they had a debate between a person affiliated with a large French bank and a regular MP in the European Parliament. And essentially, the argument was, well, who should pay for these bonds? And the guy, you know, was basically saying that the bondholders have to take responsibility for the risk that they associate with investing in Greece. And on your research menu, could you also look at Argentina? Because unfortunately, and this is maybe a second part, if this keeps on popping up that, wow, isn't Argentina successful and they defaulted on their bonds? What was it, the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s? And look, they've come back. I don't think that's necessarily a fair analogy to Greece because they're in a zone, as you might say, an economic eurozone. But everyone says, wow, that has to be an option and stuff like that. And I'm just horrified at that. And finally, when we say high spending and high debt, of course, we mean high government debt, correct, and high government spending.
Yes.
Right? You could have private debt go up and private spending, right? So I guess I've asked you about three different questions, so see if you can untangle that for me.
Yes, certainly by high debt and deficit, we mean high sovereign debt and deficit, that is high government spending more than it takes in. And let me be clear again, the problem is not on the revenue side. None of these countries fail to tax enough. They all tax too much. And that's where the magic number of somewhere between 17 and 19% of gross domestic product. When governments try to collect more than 17 to 19% of gross domestic product, they fail to do it. And what all they do is slow the economy to make it even harder to collect that. So that's one of the problems. In terms of Greece, what they tried is they promised a lot more than 17 to 19% of spending, and so they couldn't collect on it, and so they're basically bankrupt. But the problem in Greece is the problem mostly of government pensions. I think they're trying to raise the retirement age from 58 to 60, and that's a difficult thing. That's why there's rioting in the streets, is nobody wants to work the extra 2 years at 58 and 59. They all want to be able to retire. And that's ridiculous. Americans, at least, and I think this is part of the reason why the recovery in America has been at least better, Americans still have a much higher work ethic, and we have a higher work ethic because up until 2 years ago, the government was not trying to confiscate the lion's share of everything we did. Economic freedom fell off a cliff 2 years ago. The high debt and deficit spending of the Bush administration, I wrote articles against it. In Bush's reelection campaign, I said the deficit is Bush's fault. That was the title of one of my columns. But in 8 years of Bush's debt and deficit, Barack Obama beat that in 2 years, in the first 2 years of his term. So
he not only beat it, he well exceeded it.
Yes, he well exceeded it. So economic freedom fell off a cliff. We fell out of the Heritage Foundation's free category into their mostly free category, and that's a direct result of all of the things that were put in place. And I'm glad to say that most of the rioting in the United States and the protests have been from the Tea Party. We're protesting against the government, and that's my hope for America, is that we will curb government spending, whereas Greece is protesting to keep their 58-year-old retirement age, and that's ridiculous. So who should bear the burden in Greece? Yes, it's true, the bond holders should bear a big piece of the burden, but if they bear that piece of the burden, Greece should simply default. That's how they bear the burden. Greece should default. Greece shouldn't get bailed out and the bondholders take a cut too, because who's ever bailing them out needs to bail out the bondholders. That's what it means to not default. So Greece has a problem. They don't want to default, because if they default, then they won't be able to continue to borrow money. And so that's a negotiation now. If they're not going to default, then there's a negotiation between bondholders and who's ever trying to keep the bondholders from crying default. So that's a tricky thing to do, and I've no doubts that they will try not to default, and they'll try to negotiate with the bondholders for taking a piece of the cut, but not the entire cut that they'd have to take by default. And that way everyone loses less.
So if Greece defaults, I'm trying to get a picture of what this would actually look like, practically speaking, particularly internally. What happens to the country if they can't borrow anymore, and what does that mean for the people that live there?
Well, it's very similar as to when you or I would go bankrupt. Once you've gone bankrupt for 10 years, it's very difficult for you to get credit. Now, with Greece, it might not be 10 years, but it might be 10 years. They would have to live within their means. And for most of us who think that government needs to stand on its own two feet, living within your means is what government should always be doing. So it's a good idea in that regard, which is why, you know, the newly elected Congress could simply hold the line and say, we're not going to increase the deficit. They have the political power to do that. And it's an option. What it means is that government would need to trim enough to be able to service its debt or default. And that's the stark reality we're going to face at one point or another. And every time I have a client come in who's deep into credit card debt, I say, what would you do if you didn't have credit cards? And they say, well, then I couldn't spend the money, I guess. And I say, well, then don't spend the money, because it's either that or you're going to go into bankruptcy. And that's the stark reality that every one of us faces when we're in a high debt and deficit situation. And it's the same thing that countries face. They have to stop spending. And spending is the problem, not revenue.
But they don't want to make those tough decisions, David Morata. And I think here is the problem. You have too many people who realize they can buy votes by handing out these things. And so when they come up against a debt ceiling, what they would start to do would they'd start to cut law enforcement. They'd start to cut the military. They'd start to cut things that are going to really rile people, as opposed to cutting things like we covered on the program yesterday, which was an $85 million proposed program at the federal level on breastfeeding education, the thing that is probably the most natural and longest known way to feed somebody known to man that doesn't need any teaching at all. The government wants to spend $85 million on that when we're facing such a crisis. So I think you could see that we're really in trouble.
Yeah, and again, to quote from Thomas Sowell's article today, their anger should be directed against those politicians who were irresponsible enough to set up these costly programs without putting aside enough money to pay for the promises that were made, promises that now cannot be kept, regardless of which political party controls the government.
Unfortunately, we have short memories, and I'm not holding my breath on people putting the blame where it belongs.
but it is true that all of us need to stop looking for government solutions that cost government money. That is the answer. What we need is more libertarians and less Republicans and Democrats.
Yes, indeed.
News, weather, interviews, and more on demand anytime. WINA.com. Nutrition for your mind. Only on News Radio 1070 WINA.
Pittsburgh are rolling down that eastern seaboard.
Heading into the final few minutes with David Morata. He's online at emorata.com. He's the president of Morata Wealth Management. And we did have somebody who wants to know how to get in touch with you, David. So we gave the website. It's emorata.com, but maybe an email address or another way to get in touch with you.
Simply david@emorata.com comes directly to me.
Okay, that's terrific. So as we're looking at all of this, and you know, there are countries that have a lot better economic freedom. There are some that have much lower debt, but we live in America. We're certainly concerned with what goes on around us. What happens? I mean, how can we possibly get out of this? I was looking at a news report that came out about a week to 10 days ago, basically saying that the average, and I'm doing this from memory, but the average American family was basically in government debt to the tune of about $500,000 to $600,000 per family. I don't remember exactly what that was based on, but I certainly remember reading that story. How do we ever get out from under this? I mean, we can grow our way out, but it's going to take a long time, and that involves immediate discipline. And the problem is, as soon as we start growing, these pandering politicians are going to go, look, the money's coming in. I mean, our own governor has done it. The money's coming in. We can now restore government to where it was before.
Well, there's two different ways that we need to work to try to gain more economic freedom and lower debt and deficit. The first one, to gain more economic freedom, there's three different areas of our economy which are highly regulated. They're financials, energy, and now healthcare. In terms of financials, we need to repeal Sarbanes-Oxley.
Mm-hmm.
It was put in place to after the Enron scandal. Enron, from the top of the scandal to the bottom, lost about $11 billion. Sarbanes-Oxley cost us $33 billion every year. It's like having
It's like having
three Enrons every single year, and it did not prevent the financial meltdown of 2008. So the one thing it was supposed to help, it didn't help, and instead it's burdening us with three Enrons every single year in terms of compliance costs spread out over every single publicly priced and traded company in America.
Is there any movement right now afoot to make this happen? Has anybody proposed the repeal of Sarbanes-Oxley?
You know, certainly the freedom-loving members of Congress are all for that, and
mm-hmm.
a lot's been written about it. It doesn't yet have enough political oomph behind it to get it passed.
Okay.
The Frank Dodd bill that was passed last summer, there's some talk about repealing that only because it's more recent. Sarbanes-Oxley is now 9 years old. Mm. Really, both of them need to be repealed and something else put in their place that's less onerous on publicly priced and traded companies. Obamacare has incredibly hurt the healthcare industry. The healthcare industry last year was the second worst performing sector behind utilities. And what's going to happen is healthcare, which used to be America had the lion's share of healthcare, is now going to move to Switzerland. Switzerland has two of the biggest healthcare companies. It has high economic freedom. It has low debt and deficit. And Switzerland is going to become the healthcare mecca of the world in terms of pharmaceutical companies and healthcare companies because the United States is going to be so hamstrung. Again, you can't bet on a hamstrung horse. And that's the problem with all of these regulations. And there's similar regulations within the energy circuit that's hurting America in that category as well. What hasn't been hurt yet is technology, but I continue to see proposal after proposal to legislate what cookies browsers can put on you on your browser and how much they can tax the internet and how much they can tax technology and regulate technology. If they go that route, the only thing that America is still left as the best in the world will suddenly become not the best in the world, and technology will move to someplace other than the U.S. that has higher economic freedom and lower debt and deficit.
There's a lot of talk, David Morata, about the dollar losing its ability to be, I guess, the basis for the world currency. In other words, if they dump the dollar for the basis of oil trading, or if they dump the dollar in some other way, what happens to this country?
Yeah, but before World War II, the pound, the British pound, was mm-hmm. the currency of the world. And after World War II, it became the U.S. dollar. And that certainly helped the United States and hurt Great Britain. If a similar switch happens, the United States will get hurt, primarily because of all the dollars that will suddenly flow back into the United States, making the dollar even less valuable. The problem is they were talking about making the euro the global currency,
mm-hmm.
and the euros had tremendous problems with the Greece
yeah.
meltdown. So there's not another great contender out there
yuan?
Yet. Maybe, although you know, although maybe not. It's
mm-hmm.
not as widespread. So if we can maintain the dollar as the strength of the dollar, we'll be doing well. But we can't because we have to devalue it because that devalues the debt and deficit we have to pay back. So it's a very tricky, can we keep the dollar strong enough to be the global currency? And can we continue to weaken it enough to try to get ourselves out of our debt situation? It's a very difficult situation, but I would bet on the dollar gradually slipping lower and lower
mm-hmm.
at a gradual rate, not a fast rate. So it'll hold its value enough to continue to be the world currency, but not enough to really to put your money in it and feel very comfortable about it.
And I guess that's the trillion-dollar question, is can we actually maintain the dollar as the world currency? I guess it will remain to be seen. David Morata, thanks so much for joining us today. The costs of low economic freedom and high debt. Visit him online at emorata.com. We'll look forward to next time.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, speaking of Sarbanes-Oxley, it kind of brought a story to mind. It was within the recent past of my employment in this company that I had asked somebody, some powers that be up the line, if it was at all possible that I could be working on my computer at home and editing sound that were on the home on the studio's computers here. So could I have a connection here so I can work? I'll spend more time working if I can do it from home. And the answer was no, because of Sarbanes-Oxley. Sorry, you can't connect from your home here because of Sarbanes-Oxley. And I was thinking, you know, what is this all about? What's going on here in this country that we're limiting that sort of freedom? And it's a small thing, but you could probably take that and just multiply it all across the country by thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of people who are inhibited. And as David said, it's costing us three Enrons every single year to administer this thing. And what a drain on the economy. That's money that's just going for nothing. It's money that could be used to boost the economy. People could use it in their own businesses to hire more people. Instead, they're worried about complying with ridiculous laws. The Shilling Show will be back after the break. Much more to follow. Stay with us. Now she thinks that I love-